that are not so controversial or don't have massive opposition to them. So we can get through those quickly, and then when we take it to the bigger committee, we can say that these are the points that were sort of like agreed on by everyone and there's no problem. But we do have some clauses that are a little bit controversial and don't have consensus, but we'll park those today. So what I'd like to do is I'd like for Advocate Funimova to lead us through. Every member's got a policy decisions to be made document, and we're going to go through those clause by clause, and we're going to try and get through as much as possible on stuff that we all agree on. Thank you. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you. Good morning, members, colleagues. The first issue that we need to look at was there was a concern that we refer to debt intervention applicants as that it must be a citizen of South Africa. But that was simply because we developed that definition from the definition of indigent when we looked at municipal measures and how they deal with indigent persons. So the Act itself is open to any person. And my recommendation would be that it should be the person who is able to qualify should be a natural person. I think we agree, shouldn't it be a juristic person?
Sorry, can you just... Which page are you on?
Sorry,
are you on page?
Sorry,
yes. Oh, we didn't go through that.
I think we should record that the apologies if there are any, because other members of the subcommittee are not here.
Yes, thank you for that correction. Sorry about that, Advocate. Yes, can you tell us if there's any apologies?
Chair, we have an apology from Mr. McPherson, who's a medical apology, and Ms. Longwini, both are medical apologies.
Thank you very much. Just going back to what I was saying, where are you on this document? Because the first bullet there, it does we're talking about.
No. Sorry, it actually does, but it's just a short question. So the question is, should the measure be available to all persons who can apply for a debt review? Now, what we did was, we said that the measure is available to citizens. The problem is that that is not the case with debt review. Debt review is available to natural persons. So my proposal would be, and in fact, the opinion by the DTI indicated that there's a concern about the fact that we're limiting this measure to be only available to citizens, as any person can enter into a credit agreement in South Africa. So they were of the view that it should be available to everyone. Hand in hand with that is then your joint estate, household income, and joint debt. Perhaps the NCR can just give us a little bit of guidance how debt review works in respect of joint estates. How do those applications work? But if that is available under a debt review, I would be of it would be my recommendation that the measure should be available to everyone that can apply for debt review, and it should not be limited to citizens.
Members, what do you think? Honourable Montoya.
I am not sure, Chairperson. I am a lay person in as far as the law is concerned, but I am worried about South Africa being so liberal to people who are not citizens of South Africa, whilst we don't get the same treatment in their country. What informs that? We are not a developed country. We are a developing country. So why should we extend this debt relief to everyone who comes to South Africa and open and be committed into a debt? Why should we do? I don't know. I'm a lay person as far as law is concerned, but that's my feeling.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we must look at this from a constitutional point of view. You know, if we exclude anyone, would there be a repercussion going forward? As we said before, we don't want this bill to land up in the court. So I think we must ask ourselves, if we exclude anyone based on the fact that they're not a citizen or not, or any other status, what would be the effect of that? If they decide that they feel aggrieved, and then they go to court. So that should inform our answer, I think. Obviously, we must also look at the socioeconomic impact on the country as a whole. So I think there's two legs to answering the question. It's constitutional leg and a socioeconomic impact leg. Thank you.
Could, yes, the tribunal.
Thanks, Chair. I think we can start by reminding ourselves that the Bill of Rights applies to everyone. It doesn't distinguish between human beings. The other thing is now coming to citizens. That would exclude people like permanent residents and people on temporary permits who have work permits, which means they are earning in the country and they are also having obligations and they've got access to all these services that we all consume and goods. Then it would exclude them, and I think the constitutional attacks would flow from that. The other portion would be to look at people like refugees and asylum seekers. Since our law allows them to work in the country, then it allows them to have access to services, goods, even credit and so on. So excluding them inadvertently could also lead us to that kind of constitutional problem. Thanks.
So what do we think, members? Do we think that we should just put this on, we should just shelve this for the moment, or do you think we should just accept it? Because of the fact that our Bill of Rights, it doesn't discriminate between if you're a South African citizen or not. It's, we want to, as South Africans, we want to create a better society, including the foreigners who live here. So I don't think we should separate them from our... So can we? Can do we agree that we, they are included? So that this clause, are we agreed? If we're not agreed, you must say we're not agreed.
No, sir, we don't want this bill to be challenged. Anything that will protect it so that it sees the dawn, we'll learn to stay with it.
Yes, thank you. I think it's, the answer is clear. You know, the Bill of Rights applies to everyone. We can't exclude people arbitrarily just based on citizenship or not. Those people who are here in various ways contribute to the economy as well when they work. So, you know, we need to afford the same protection to them in the end of the day. I think the real questions are, again, what are the financial limitations, you know, in terms of income, no assets and all of those things. That's the real criteria we're looking at, but not an individual in itself, who they are and where they come from.
Okay, so you've got that. We agree. We can move to the next section, clause.
Just before we move, could we just understand maybe from the NCR, what is the situation with joint estates and joint debt and debt review?
Okay. Thank you, Honourable.
No. It's broken. It's the UDM there.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. In terms of debt cancelling, if there is a joint estate or you are married in community of property, you are considered to be one. So the income of both parties is taken into consideration, including liabilities. So you are considered to be one person. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would then recommend that is what the bill should be applicable to. If you married in community property, it will be a joint application.
Okay.
But then the next one is, should the measure only be available to persons who are over-indebted? Now, if I could just take members back a little bit. Initially, we had over-indebted, and in fact, that is in our long title, that is everything that the bill speaks about, is to relieve household over-indebtedness. Then when we started looking at who qualifies, and the information that the committee at that stage had around the 7,500 indicated that all of these people qualifying would be over-indebted. And because of that, the committee removed the word over-indebted. We looked at various formula to determine affordability and all of these things, and it just became so complicated that the committee said, no, let's just say you qualify if you are earning up to 7,500. However, the statistics that we then got now in this quarter indicate that about 50% of the consumers that earn less than 7,500 are actually paying. They're not even in arrears. They are doing quite well. I think in the end it's only 21% of those consumers that are actually really in trouble where there's like 9 months or more in arrears. So I think that was initially the intention of the bill, that it should be only if you are over indebted, that is when you will make use of the measure. So my recommendation would be that it must be clear from the bill that you must be over indebted before you can qualify.
Members?
If you agree, you must say that you agree, so that it's on record. Otherwise, I could just be sitting in this room by myself, you know.
Yes, well, I think the interpretation is good. There must be some sort of criteria, and if you look at the Credit Act itself, it talks about over-indebtedness, and I think that's the criteria on which you should go forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think the wording is correct, over indebted. Because we are not saying anyone who not servicing the debt is qualified. We need the over indebted, not anyone that is not qualified. Thanks.
I just have one question around this. I know it might be taking us back. But what's to stop me from, if I'm earning 7,500 rands and I am servicing my debt, and Andre here is earning 7,500 rand and he's over indebted, what's to stop me from just stopping paying back so that I also become over indebted? I can say I'm also over indebted. So surely by making it only over indebted people, it might be an incentive to other people to become over indebted in order to qualify for this. Is that, you know, what do we think of that? Can we just have a discussion around this? Because I don't want to... We don't want to pass a bill that then incentivizes people to become over-indebted so that they can get some of their debt written off. If we can comment on that, Honourable Mantashe.
I don't know which term can I use, because I'm asking myself, if I live in Sandton and I'm owning 3 Mercedes-Benz and at some point I decide not to pay, I will have a lot of debt, but I'm a somebody who is able to, but I decide to stop. Shall I be able to apply for the debt relief? If we say everyone who is over indebted.
Within the criteria.
This one doesn't talk about any criteria. It's saying anyone who is over indebted, to everyone who is over indebted. That's my concern. Rich people can also be over indebted.
Like we are.
Thanks, Chair. I think in the example that you just made, Chair, if the two of you, one is over indebted, the other one is not, and then he decides not to pay. I mean, my assumption is that when you apply for a debt intervention process, you need to provide evidence in terms of what are the reasons why are you not in a position to pay your debt. And even if there are signs that you are over indebted, it is also the responsibility, because in terms of the affordability assessment criteria, there's an expense norm that actually puts you at a particular level where credit providers need to ensure that they don't actually give you further credit if you are still okay. And if they happen to give you further credit, you just fall into the over-indebtedness line. So I'm just trying to say, I think there are measures to cap what that kind of a situation that you're coming up with. Because the fact that I'm going to be stopping the payment, I should provide reasons why am I stopping, whereas there's cash flow that gets into my account that indicates that I can be able to service the debt. It's just that it's an unwillingness on my side, which actually kicks me out in terms of the debt intervention process. Mm. That's what I wanted to clarify. So I think we'll be able to deal with that particular sort of unintended consequences, so to speak.
Chair, I don't know, because I believe or if you apply, there's a process that you go through, and must be indicated as to what is it that you own and how much do you have, blah, blah, before you can qualify. You see? The name over-indebted is fine, you can use it, that one is fine, but when the application, you go through your application, you'll find out, no, there's a challenge in terms of you open it. You don't want to pay, not that, that you are indebted.
Okay, so that we're agreed then, that it'll be over-indebted as a criteria, over-indebted, 7.5, that sort of thing. Yeah, we're all agreed. Honorable Mantashe agreed.
Yeah, because I want to win in this meeting.
You can win. You can.
What we must remember is these clauses are all in the bill, but the bill also says that there is, you must earn less than 7.5. So this is in relation to you earning less than, over indebted in relation to you earning less than 7.5. That hasn't changed yet, so we haven't changed that. So while we're doing these, so it's, yeah.
This is what the advocate is saying, that the recent statistics have shown that people of that level of 7,500, most of them do pay their debts. Yeah?
Yeah.
For me, the question would be then, what do we do to ensure that we don't discourage those people who are paying because they are 7.5? Should we really put this cap of 7,500, or should we do something else that would enable people who have the ability to pay, although they're at 7,500? Because we don't want to discourage paying people paying that debt. We just try to have those who cannot. I don't know.
Sorry, before we go there, when we get to that clause, then we can discuss that whole 7.5, that question there. I think that's the way to do it. Because we are going to get there. It is going to happen. It's not closed. Nothing's closed. So if we just go through it, so now we've done the first one, the second one, we said over-indebted is going to stay in place, and then we go through the ones that are perceived as more consensus than others. Yes, Honourable Thomas.
I think the principle is fine. There could be unintended consequences, as you have rightly showed. So I think we can revisit it at some point and ask ourselves, what measures are in place right now to make sure that a person is defined as over-indebted, and how do we make sure it is the truth? Because it's about truthfulness that we're talking about here. So we must find measures to engage with that question and find an answer. But the principle itself is fine. And I think we can revisit and ask ourselves what criteria and measurements we can put in place to make sure that the person is honest and the person won't willfully default to fall under these circumstances and get the benefits from it. Thank you.
DG?
Morning, members and everyone. Thank you, Chairperson. I agree with Albert, what he's saying about the criteria. We need a criteria and to make sure that there are those measures in place to ensure that there are no unintended consequences. So it's something that must be, the principle is taken into consideration. However, we need to look into that because it's got a potential of abuse. There are people who might actually go now and abuse the system on this basis. So that must be tightened. Thank you.
Just to add, Chair, it's my assumption that if we adopt the principle in the bill, it becomes an act of parliament for areas of implementation where we come up with the criteria. Mm-hmm. It's just an area for regulation where everybody who has to apply will have to comply with this particular criteria.
Yeah.
So I take it that the principle is okay.
Yeah.
the issues in terms of you are 7,500 candidate, but you must have been, you know, over indebtedness as defined by the Act under the following circumstances. That is an area that we can perhaps populate it in the regulation as a matter of principle, so that when people apply, they know exactly here is the criteria. I'm just trying to sort of differentiate between the two processes. The actual process of saying you are this specific consumer who needs debt intervention should actually be determined by the regulation process, as opposed to the agreed principle of saying you want someone who's at 7,500 and all of them.
Yes, I agree. That's the fine print. But I think we need to co-design it with you. You know, it shouldn't be something that's designed somewhere else, because this is our bill. We must also understand, you know, what's going to be in the regulation thing. Because the regulation can come up with things that you know, sort of places an obstacle in our way that we didn't intend, you know, in terms of what we intended to design in the first place.
Thank you, Chief. Maybe if I can just also respond to a number of these things. In respect of the over-indebted first, it was absolutely intended, because currently, in fact, none of the comments itself were not really attacking the 7,500 limit. So I actually do not have that as a policy decision that has to be decided. I know that in the meeting of the committee, there were questions about the 7,500. So that could perhaps be looked at then. But definitely currently it is 7,500, 50,000 debt. And the question just is, do we add the word over indebted? Because most of the people who earn under 7,500 are in fact paying. So we don't want their debt to be scheduled, they are paying. The question about whether someone else will now stop paying, I think that was definitely answered. I agree with that. If you go through the debt review process, it will simply be structured because you will be able to pay. So, you know, if the only thing that might happen is that you might be able to maybe gain a little bit on interest or something like that, but you will pay. And if you could actually pay the current interest because you are, that is what the system will in the end show you can pay. So I think that the measures are in fact there. Then we have a criminal offence in the bill, that if you structure your finances in such a way that you then qualify for the measure, that is regarded as an offence. Fine, that will have to be reported, or it will have to be detected by the person who is doing the assessment. If it is that done by the regulator, they could put measures in place for themselves to say, look, these are the red flags. If a person suddenly sold off all the assets and gambled the money away, over a week, you know, no previous gambling records or anything like that, then the NCR could say, wait a second, it looks like you've structured your finances in order for you to qualify, and that will then be an offence. So when we look at the offences, currently that is a 10-year penalty, which in fact we were asked if that's not too harsh. But following this discussion, you know, that is the kind of thing that we need to think about then, if it is in fact too harsh. Because if you are abusing the system, you could affect a number of other vulnerable persons. So I do think that there are enough measures in place to counter the things that could happen for someone to come into play.
Thank you. We can move to the next one.
Thank you, Chair. The next one is... this is actually the big one, the really big question. Currently the bill sets up a separate measure. It envisages a debt review done by the NCR, but we didn't call it a debt review. It is part of the debt relief measure. The idea, however, is that the NCR will follow the similar systems that are followed by debt counsellors. The problem is that this was seen by the public as not the least interference that could be done when you are depriving someone of their property. They were saying that and the opinion supported this, that why are we not making use of existing measures? Why are we having this new measure in place that seems a little bit vague in its application? It's not clearly spelled out. The role of the credit provider is not clearly spelled out. So the proposal that I made to the committee and I'm making again is that let us make use of the current debt review system. We empower the NCR, that is the proposal, to, with whatever measure, whether it's the NCR employing people, outsourcing people, creating a form of a subsidy support or something, however which way that is done, the NCR is empowered to allow people who earn up to 7,500 to undergo debt review, the proper current debt review as it stands in the Act. So the only change is the how. It won't be done by debt counsellors as such. It will be done through something that the NCR creates, whether it's capacity or finances. That's a different issue. Then if you go through the debt review process, and it solves all these other constitutional issues as well, because now the credit provider is very much participating in the process. So we solve the procedural fairness concerns as well. We look at whether the person can pay, so it's the least interference. When you get to the point where the system that you then use to tell you whether this person can repay, whether you are removing, bringing interest rate a little bit down, extending installments, things like that, if you see that over a period, for instance, of 5 years, this person will never be able to repay the debt. Perhaps it is someone who, because remember we need to exclude the reckless lending. If it is someone who earns 500 rand a month and they come to a debt counsellor or to the NCR with 50,000 rand in debt, your first question is, how did you ever get this debt? This should never have been. So those will be reckless lending cases, and they will be dealt with separately, because that's a contract that can then be set aside. But you'll probably be looking at someone who maybe was earning 7,500 rand or 8,000 rand, then was laid off, retrenched, or lost the job because of illness or whatever, and then the person is now struggling to make those payments. So if you can see this person is not going to be able to solve, is what they call it, so this person cannot repay this money in a reasonable period of time, then that person is then referred by the NCR to the tribunal for an order to suspend. So this is then exactly the same as our measure was. So the NCR would have seen what you can pay, and those would have been the proposals. Now that can be done through the debt review system. But then we add to the debt review system this additional thing. If you cannot solve, how do we assist you? And the way we assist you is by suspending, and then after a period of time, and that is another policy question, how many times should we suspend to allow you enough time to get back up on your feet, then we extinguish the debt at that stage. So this whole explanation is to ask the policy question, would it be in order for us to use existing measures, or should we continue with this in a separate, almost a part in the Act as we are doing now, so that it's a separate process all by itself, or can we use existing measures? And my proposal would be, because it addresses some of the constitutional concerns and it makes it clear that we are using existing measures, we are simply we're importing something into that existing measure, and we're making that measure better, that would then be more acceptable constitutionally to the public when they look at the bill. So that would be the proposal.
Members?
I assume then a person would then approach a debt counsellor, the normal process, and the debt counsellor would then do an analysis and see, well, this person, okay, there's no reckless credit, but this person is over indebted to a degree that falls within the parameters of debt extinguishing and not debt restructuring, and then would make a choice to go down that route and assist the person. That's basically what we're talking about. Am I right?
No. The way I see it is, the person would, let's say I'm the over-indebted one again, I would approach the NCR and say, I'm over-indebted, I want debt relief measures, with the form. and then they would put me through the debt counseling, debt review system, through their system that they've got, which is exactly the same as the private sector system, except it's going through their system. So that it, and then they consult with the credit provider eventually, and there's a whole process to find out whether or not I'm over indebted or not. So the system isn't going to a credit a service provider initially, it's going to the national, the NCR initially. So we're keeping it NCR, but the same mechanism is being used as what's currently used. That's correct, man. So that's the procedure. DTI.
The idea is quite okay, but I would like to caution the committee around the issue of the wording. If we make reference to debt review, it's going to create an impression that we are NCR is trying to close the debt canceling business, by actually inviting consumers go to NCR for a debt review process as opposed to a debt intervention process. So because the criteria is clear. If you add 7,500, by default, if you go to a debt council, you are kicked out.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you need to go to a NCR for a debt intervention process. If we coin it as a debt review process, you might find that the bill will be challenged on the basis that the NCR is actually now conducting debt review process, thereby closing the businesses of debt companies. So the wording needs to be quite,
We understand. First of all, and we do understand, but secondly,
and
before,
and they will close.
Yes, we just want to. I just want to say, you don't caution the committee; you advise the because cautioning us, you know, we might caution you, and then, so can we have some a different word, so there's no confusion with the public? That's what we want to do. We don't want to confuse the two together, and then it will be chaos.
Chair, I think that can be done simply by drafting. So I'm looking at the drafters here behind me, who's going to assist the committee as well. Who's going to assist me to redraft the bill. So what we can do is we can still make use of the debt review process, but we will simply say that we'll change the name, and we'll say that the regulator will then conduct a debt intervention process according to the process envisaged in that section. So then we're still using the existing system, but it is clear that it's a different process.
Chairperson, bear with me. All of you comrades, please bear with me. I just want to clarify. Currently, the poorest of the poor do not have access to the debt review process because they can't afford it. Where are they in what we are saying now?
We have debt intervention that we are discussing now. So they will be
which?
The ones.
Huh?
Let me come in. So basically, what we're saying is currently as we sit here today, poor people can't access the debt review mechanism because they can't afford it. Like we said, we were told yesterday, what was 8,000 rands yesterday?
They can't afford it.
No, absolutely. So in the new system that we're putting in place, those people will go to the NCR and they'll go through a debt review system. Well, it won't be called debt review, we'll have another word for it. it's the same process. And then at the end of that process, there's either they can either get their debt suspended, their payment suspended until they can afford to repay, and then if they can't do that, then their debt will be extinguished. Yeah, that's correct. So we're all happy, and we accept that and the change that you're going to make there. Thank you. And if you move to the next, DGG.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering if it would assist maybe to have somewhere in the bill where we explain that this target market was not catered for anywhere before, just for that clarification. No.
Wait, is that?
It is actually currently in the preamble.
Okay, so we can now move to the next one.
Okay, the next point is actually, now that we've agreed on that, it is something that is not going to be in the bill, but it speaks to what like what Albert just mentioned, that this committee should be co-creator of the process. So there were a number of, so if we accept that there's going to be this debt review with the NCR, there were a number of proposals, and I think I know what the answer is, but there needs to be a decision on that. So the number of proposals for how the NCR will be doing this debt review, because concerns were raised about the NCR's capacity. So the question that I'm looking at now is, if we're using existing measures, how is access to debt review ensured, the costs involved? So will it be that NCR will create capacity? Will it be that NCR will outsource, or will there be a subsidy created? The reason why we need to know more or less that answer is that it might affect issues that come out in the bill. So it seems to me that the overall agreement is that we need to add to the functions of the NCR to allow them to employ persons who will be able to do debt intervention as described in the bill. And then that will just be a matter of changing their functions. If we feel that there should be other methods, outsourcing we don't have to provide for, that would be part of procurement. So if they feel that they can't do all the work, then that is normal procurement that will happen. If we feel there needs to be a subsidy, then we need to think about whether this is something that we need to provide for. DTI does have incentives that are not provided for in legislation, but they also have that are provided for in legislation. So I think the decision would just be, do we have to go that route or not? Is it a question that we have to solve right now if we agree that it is the NCR who's going to employ people or outsource? And if we agree that it's a question that we don't have to answer now, it is then something that can, if DTI feel when they do the review of their legislation that they actually need to have something in law, that they can bring at that stage. So the question is simply, we are going to add to the functions, that is what it seems to me. Do we have to make any other provisions in the bill?
Members?
I think the NCR must help us here because they know their own capacity and limitations and so forth. So we must hear from them, I think.
Yep. NCR?
NCR
Thank you. Definitely NCR will need to be capacitated. We'll need additional resources. We did make a presentation the other day in terms of the number of intervention officers that we'll definitely need. We'll need to build a system. The bill also requires us to establish a register. So, yes, obviously there are costs involved. Now, what we could also probably look at is that whilst we are getting all of that in place, we could, you know, in the meantime, you know, outsource, you know, some of the work, follow PFMA, you know, in that regard. But we would really want to build the capacity in-house to do the work.
Thank you. Could the DDG come in from the department and tell us about the... Just sorry, before you, Honourable Montoya.
I am... From where I'm seated, Chairperson, I am anti-outsourcing. From whatever state or entity, I don't agree with outsourcing. Rather, the NCR tells us, in fact, they told us the other day, how they want to be capacitated. But outsourcing for me is out of question. If we continue in that fashion, it means, in fact, for me, it is wrong to privatize public service. If that this process is a public service, it must not be outsourced.
Thank you, Chair. We as the DTI, we are fully in support of the strengthening of the capacity of the NCR. In the previous presentation, we outlined the different issues and areas that we will need capacity on in terms of the funding and the human resourcing, even the system infrastructure areas that should be factored in. So it's something that if it's approved, we will be able to take forward within our budgetary appropriation levels. So we note the input about the outsourcing, but it's something that we also felt it would enhance the processes, especially in areas where access issues are there, for example, in rural areas, that if we find reputable debt counselors that can be outsourced to address those areas, it will enhance also this capacity. Thank you.
Can you comment? I also take the point of outsourcing. We're not happy to take all this money and give it back to basically everybody that's doing the job now. That would be really bad. So we are keen on the staying in-house. Okay.
I just wanted to add a point around the issue of incentives. With the current behavior of debt counselors, I think we are proposing to the committee that we need to do away with the incentivizing of debt counselors to do the work. I think we will find ourselves in the same situation where you find lawyers standing in front of the court waiting for people, asking if they were involved in the MVA, all those things. Consumers will be harassed by debt counselors because they know that there's sort of an incentive that is currently being given by the department. You know, so in order to actually care for that particular behavior, we rather not enter that space and close the issue of incentives. In the meantime, let's capacitate NCR. The debt intervention process would be, I mean, free for applicants, and capacity would be built as sort of a work in progress, as proposed by the DDG and the CEO. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, got that. Good. We can move to the next one. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is whether assets should be part of the criteria. Now, when you look at whether assets should be part of the criteria, the concern raised was how will the NCR be able to verify that a person actually has assets or that they are not, maybe not disclosing some of the assets? Or if they say, I do have assets, how do we know that when they say, I've got a television that's worth 500 rand, that the television is not in fact worth 10,000 rand? How do they verify that? It became such a headache, and a lot of comments also said, but your second-hand value might not be my second-hand value. How do we know what it is? What is Swiftly? If we say, okay, you can take it to cash converters, but that is maybe not the actual value of the thing, and now you're forcing people to sell the assets. So one comment was actually that if you look at this group of 0 to 7,500, you're going to find a very small percentage that actually has any assets that can be realized anyway. So why do you want to focus on this? Rather see if the person can, in fact, pay their debt or not. And if they can't, then they go through the process. So there was a concern that, okay, but now we're moving away from the no income, no assets. And how we can perhaps address that is to find something to indicate in the debt review process, so we'll have to amend the full process for everyone, to put something in there to say that a debt counsellor must look at the assets of the consumer to see if assets could be realised to assist in repayment of debt. So not a it must be realised, just that this is one of the considerations. I'm not sure about the wording, we'll have to propose some wording. But as I understand from the NCR, debt counsellors are already doing that. So you would come and you would say, look, I'm currently driving like a very nice Volkswagen Golf. They would say, I think that your repayment on this Golf is about 5,000 a month. If you sell the Golf and you buy maybe, well, use my car, a Peugeot, then you can pay 2,000 a month. There's already 3,000 that's opened up. So that kind of advice. So perhaps not about selling the assets, but about, you know, how assets can be used to also alleviate the person's over-indebtedness. We'll have to sit with the NCR to come up with wording, but the principle is that we take assets out of the criteria and we rather make it part of the debt review process so that assets are considered in some way. I know we don't like the idea of people having to sell the assets in order to pay other debts. That's not what we want. So I'm very aware of that. But the kind of advice that could assist the person to use their assets in such a way that they relieve their over-indebtedness themselves. So we could rather add something like that there and then remove assets, because I think it is going to cause a lot of problem. You're going to have a lot of fraudulent claims. You're going to have people saying that they don't have assets, whereas they actually might have assets. And then because it is a requirement, it becomes something that DTI would have to police. And that then increases the costs of actually doing the assessment, et cetera, et cetera.
Thanks. I think that's the common need of the NCR to regulate even those companies that are outside, so national credit, review, tax review. Yeah, maybe they must put in place things to can be able to monitor as to, in terms of the assets, is this guy qualifying, how much does he have, the house, the bond, the incentives, and so forth. I think they are. They are commanded as an NCR, but you can hear from them. Thank you.
Before we hear from the NCR, members, do you want to comment on what my touch on?
I want to align myself with what the advocate is saying.
It's a difficult practical issue to ascertain what the truth is, you know, in terms of assets. So even if you say they must be policed, how do you do that? You know, some assets can be picked up in terms of credit agreements that you will find on the credit bureaus, but not everything is there. So, you know, my sense is that what Advocate Van der Merwe proposed is probably the most sensible thing. So when the person goes through the process, he or she will be asked, do you have any assets? If they are truthful, well, yes, I've got a expensive TV, okay, can you downgrade it, you know, buy a smaller television than you have, a little bit more money available. That's probably the process to go through, because to say you must declare everything will also expose more people, especially people when they're desperate.
Absolutely.
It will expose more people to break the law.
Yeah.
And then we see these penalties are quite hectic,
yeah.
You know. So at this point, I think and, you know, many of these people probably don't have a lot of assets anyways. Which will make a lot of, I'm not saying this with any evidence in front of me, but I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
And perhaps maybe that's something we can investigate. I don't know if there's any research on this, whether people at this level do have a lot of assets that can assist them. But I think as part of the process, they must be convinced by the NCR that if you disclose everything, we can help you much better. If you hold back information about what you do have, then you know you will stay in this position. So I think the Advocate Van der Merwe's position is probably the best at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say a couple. What we're talking about here, Advocate, is assets a factor when you apply?
Yes.
Not once you've applied. So it's on the thing, 7.5, your assets of less than 10,000. We want to take that clause out, the less than whatever, 10,000.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about here. Your assets will be a factor once you're in the process.
Yes.
But
yeah.
What we're saying here is in the bill
mm.
that we've got before us, we've actually got a clause that says that you can only apply for debt relief measures if your assets are worth less than, and we want to remove that. So we all agree with that. That's what I'm trying to establish.
Yes.
So everybody agrees, so we can remove that. Yeah. Thank you. We can move to the next one. Thank you.
The next question is whether the measure should be once-off, and it goes hand-in-hand with retrospectivity. The concern, so the next one is then should the measure be once-off? If we skip the next one and we go to the next one, should the measure be available retrospectively? Because they go hand-in-hand. There were concerns raised about retrospectivity of the bill. It is not unconstitutional for a bill that deals with civil matters to be retrospective, and that is what this bill does. It deals with civil matters, but your normal constitutional principles apply. So we need to have proportionality, rationality, fairness, reasonableness, justifiable in an open and democratic society. All of those things must apply. Now, the concern that was raised is that we are depriving someone of property retrospectively. So it makes the deprivation even worse than if it was only to apply prospectively. The other side of the coin is, however, that we are sitting with people who have no measure to get out of this because they cannot buy their way out. And those aren't my words, it's words from Ms. Kutsia, who did a thesis on whether the lack of natural person insolvency systems in South Africa is actually constitutional. And throughout her thesis, she looked at discrimination, the impact, etc., and she came to the conclusion that the fact that if I own a car and a house, I can actually be sequestrated and have a fresh start where I can build myself up, regardless of the fact that I've got a job with a good income, if I'm in such a situation that I cannot pay my debts, the fact that I've got a car and a house and a couple of furniture and things that I can sell and pay to my creditors, that allows me to have a fresh start. But because I don't have a car or furniture or a house that can be sold, I simply have to slog on and I have to keep being in this position where my creditors have to phone me and then I have to get a loan from this person to pay that person, and I just keep on being in this debt trap. So her view was actually that even a debt review process, if you don't have a reasonable period for repayment, so if your period goes to 10 years or 15 years, would in fact also be unconstitutional, because you're not putting this person in the same position that you can put a person that is actually has his or her estate sequestrated. Now, if we take that argument, and I must say I agree with that argument, it makes sense to me. It is in fact what the committee started off saying. There is this gap. These people cannot help themselves. We maybe did not think of the gap as being unconstitutional, but now that the argument is made and I've looked at the argument, I agree. I think it's unconstitutional. So if our bill is addressing something that is unconstitutional, I do think that we will be able to pass constitutional muster even if it is retrospective, provided that our processes are fair, reasonable, clearly spelled out, and I think that is now what we're moving towards, using existing measures, making it clear that you have to pay if you can pay, and it's only really in those circumstances where you really cannot pay that there will be an actual extinction of the debt. Because credit providers weren't so much concerned about the fact that the reduction of interest is also deprivation of property. No one, in fact, mentioned that. The only deprivation of property that was mentioned was the fact of the extinguishing. So it seems that credit providers are okay with the fact that they need to compromise on interest and fees and these things. And if we make sure that our measure, the extinguishing measure, is really the last resort, we've given this person absolutely a fair chance to get back up on his feet, then I do think that we'll be able to pass the constitutional muster. So if we then look at that retrospectivity aspect, and we look at our date of 24 November 2017, the problem that we have is if we keep that date, that retrospective date, our bill will only be passed, even if we pass the bill in May, it still has to go through the NCOP process, so we should only have an act towards the end of 2018. So already a year would have lapsed between our date and when the act is signed. Then we need systems put in place, because there's currently no systems. The credit providers said they need systems, credit bureaus said they need systems, NCR needs systems. I think the NCT is the only one that is currently at such a stage that they can just tweak their systems and they will be able to cope. But that then puts us maybe another 12 months down the line. So you're sitting with your cutoff date being 2 years in the past, which is really not effective. The reason for the cutoff date was so that people don't go out now and incur debt just to have it extinguished. That said, it was a very logical reason for the cutoff date, a very noble reason for the cutoff date. But I would recommend that there will be retrospective without a cutoff date, and then the question comes, if it doesn't have a cutoff date, do we have to make this measure have an end date? Because remember, the cutoff date is what made it once off. So if you have a cutoff date, you would bring all your debts up until that day and you would apply. Any debt after that wouldn't qualify, so it would be once off. But if we remove the date and we make it retrospective, would we then need for this measure to have an end date? So would we need for the extinguishing the NCR to say this will only last for 12 months or 24 months or 36 months? If we take into account the fact that systems are going to be created, capacity is going to be created, the fact that it's an unconstitutional gap that actually exists, my recommendation would be that we should simply bring this measure into the bill the same way as debt review is brought into the bill, into the Act. In other words, it is simply an extension of debt review in the sense that, or not an extension, it's a duplication of debt review for people who are not able to make use of the debt review system as it is. And I think that there will always be people who will not be able to make use of the debt review system, and that therefore the NCR should be able to assist those people. We could also say that let's keep the NCR as the debt review system, but the issue of suspension and extinguishing we make subject to a 12-month or a 24-month or a 36-month. But I would again argue that you're still going to have people who will not be able to solve. If they don't earn a salary because they were retrenched, because they maybe were off sick for 6 months and they are not able to go back to work, so now they need to start relying on other measures, maybe the UIF is not even enough to cover the debt that they have, you will always have people like that. So I would recommend that it be available always. A number of comments said that it is not enough for this to be just once off. This is an ongoing need. But like I say, that is the decision for the committee. The initial plan was for this to be once off. That's why we had a date. Date is not going to work simply because of everything that still has to happen. If we take the date away, keep it retrospective, the question then just comes, do we give this an end date or do we simply say we are creating a separate process that will always be available to these people who are falling in the gap?
Albert? Yeah, it's a good question. I look at Van Mervel makes valid points. You know, in terms of assisting these income earners on this level on a permanent basis, you know, other income earners have a permanent system in place that do assist them. And I did not see the during the public hearings, I did not note all the contributions with regard to the possibility of this being a continuous system. In an ideal world, I don't think there's a problem with the principle, because it would be fair towards everyone. You know, it would provide for those people who were outside any levels of assistance to have permanent access to that. I think the question that needs to be answered is what effect it would have on microloans businesses and the banks, and how that could be ameliorated in another way. So if you keep the system as a permanent feature, how would you try and resolve the possible economic fallout that might exist? I have not seen any studies on that, so I cannot see where the dangers. Well, I can imagine where the dangers are, but I cannot see it from a scientific point of view, if I can put it that way. So, yes, I think from a fairness point of view, from a constitutional point of view, it should be an open process that's available. You know, it's interesting how the whole world is indebted in such a way that, you know, we have all of these conspiracy theories about the whole world system imploding at any moment. And so far, luckily, it hasn't happened. In interesting in biblical times, and I think other societies also had it, every 7 years they would reboot the whole system. There would be extinguishing of all debt every 7 years, and then they would restart. Right? So I'm not sure how that worked in practice, but there's something to be said that if you don't have a certain reboot, you will wind up the system to a place where it becomes unsustainable and will implode. Yeah. And what happens if it implodes? We will have a catastrophic situation in South Africa, but also the world. You know, so this is a very important philosophical question, but also a practical question that needs to be answered. I don't have an answer, but from a
a fairness point of view, equity point of view, I think it does make sense what Advocate for the Mother said. Thank you.
Honourable Montage.
Now, Chairperson, from where we sit, we would like the process to be continuous because we don't foresee any improvement in the economy for us. My assessment is that it will continue to go down. So we don't want to come back every year to say we must change the law to accommodate the poor. For us, we'll be comfortable it is a continuous process. And the rest can be modified as we go.
Okay, before I take other hands, I just want to talk on this. If we make it a continuous process, in other words, then it's just a system that's set up and we're from the day and it just goes forever, the benefits that you say, if you take the date away, this is why I'm saying, the reason why we want it to be continuous is because the date is the problem, the 27th of November 2017, and because of the process of getting the bill passed. So making it continuous, the argument that you're putting forward is not because of the benefit it'll have for the population, but because of a date. Is that what you're saying, Advocate? I just want some clarity on that. You're not saying it would be better. I'm not undermining the fact that I also think that it would be better continuous, but I want it to be decided on being continuous for not just because we feel like it this morning because we all woke up on the right side of the bed, but because there's actually a reason for it. And if you can just elaborate on that reason to me again, so that when we do change it to be continuous, because from the beginning we've been saying once-off measure, and today we're talking about a continuous measure, and we're right at the, you know, we've been discussing this for nearly 2 years now. So I just want a more, I don't know how to say it, more than just, you know, is it only the date that is making this continuous? And is there another way of doing this, taking the date out and not making it continuous? Is that an option still? I'm just looking at all of these options, because if we make it continuous, like Honourable Albert said, what is the implication on the financial sector? What is that implication? And we don't really have time to go into all of that detail. We're basically changing the whole, you know, way in which the act is, the amendment bill has been put up, because even in the preamble or the objective, we don't talk about continuous, we talk about once off. So can you just give us some more clarity on that before the department comes in? Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. No, the date is the removing the date is the thing that started the wheels clicking, to say that if we remove the date, because it's only the date that limited this to be a once-off. So yes, we can still make it a once-off if we remove the date by giving it a sunset provision. So we will say the measure will be available if we include the it could be either applicable to the NCR processes and or to the extinguishing process. So we can say this will only be available for 12 months from the commencement of the Act. So we can make it once off in that way. However, why the wheels started clicking if we take the date away is one of the reasons for Section 88F was because we saw that there might be a need for this in the future. And in fact, the one clause in 88F that is most problematic is the one that makes provision for a similar process to be followed. So if I can actually refer you to 88F, that specific clause, you'll see that it was always the intention that something better and more permanent must be created at some point. It is the 88F, subsection 3, it's on page 23 of the bill as it was published. I don't know if your bill would look the same. But it says the debt intervention measure may only benefit one or more of the following consumers. Persons, sorry, that's not the right one. Oh, here we go. Sorry. It's subsection 2. A debt intervention measure must address economic circumstances that affect any of the groups of persons referred to in subsection 3 in such a way that no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt is available to them. So 88F, subsection 2C, that was the one that would have replaced the ones of measure. So there was always an understanding that there is a need for more permanent relief for this group of people. 88F2C, the counter then is very contentious, and there's been a lot of concern about it, because the argument is that it opens it way too wide, plenary power that you're giving to the minister. So if you take all of those into account, it then you remove the date, so the reason for the once off, you remove that, and you see that it looks like 88F2C might actually be unconstitutional because it is plenary power that's given, and you bring the two together, then it speaks to a permanent measure. So it is not just about the date. The date is just what set the wheels in motion. But if you take all of the things into account, there wasn't necessarily a request for it to be permanent, but there were requests for people to be able to apply more than once, to say that there is a need. So if we take from that, the fact that there is a need, the comments were, but you can't just have people do this once. There's going to be a need for people to do it more than once. Now that speaks to not a once-off measure. That speaks to a more permanent measure. So no, it is not just the date. There is actually a rationale, and it is about looking at all the comments received as a whole, especially also 88F2C.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a legal technical question. When the public hearings were held, was there an impression given to the participants that this would be a once-off measure only, which would have resulted in them not addressing the matter as a continuous one? Because that creates a problem. If we change tack now and they were under a different impression, they would say they could argue that they weren't properly consulted. And that's one question, it's a technical one. Then the other matter is regarding the once-off can be built on the premise that an individual can, we'll have to find some criteria, can apply maximum 3 times in his lifetime, perhaps, you know, that would be something that needs to be investigated. And I think if this is something that's going to be investigated, we need to get more comments back from the industry and from people affected, the public at large. But I think the powers to decide to implement, let's say we decide, okay, this is going to run until date X, and then it's finished. And if we want to, we do have the powers to open it up again in the future. There might be such a, as Honorable Mantasha said, there's such a dire economic situation that we need to intervene. Then it can be opened up again as a process, but then the decision to do it must lie and vest with Parliament and not with the Minister. They can do it in consultation with the Minister, but because this is a bill created by Parliament, the Parliament then must run the whole process of decision making, when it will happen, how long it will be, and so forth. And then consult with the Minister on issuing regulations. I'm not sure how that interaction would work, but I think from my point of view, that would be the answer, and not put it in the hands of government. You see, because any government who's in control can use it as a political tool going forward as well, before an election and manipulate things, whereas I think Parliament would be more careful to do that in the end of the day. But I think we do need to consult again. If we're going to talk about opening this up for a second, third time, or even open continuously, then I think consultation must come back into the game. Thank you very much.
Before you come,
I just need some clarity as well. If we take the date away, because we have to put in place all this mechanism in order to this machinery to let the 1.5 million people apply for debt relief. Is it not possible for perhaps the department to say, okay, we're ready now, and then we can make that as the date? You know, some mechanism along those lines. I'm just asking Honourable Advocate Van der Merwe that question directly. The DTI can come in now, and then the advocate at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I would like to deal with quite a number of issues. I mean, when the bill was initially tabled, it had two phases, a once-off phase and the second phase, which will be prescribed by the minister. I think following the deliberations, as a DTI, I think we considered on the issue of the prescription of debt intervention by the minister to the extent of coming up with the NCR and CT process to deal with continuous, you know, applications that would be coming as a result of whatever situation that consumers would find themselves in. Perhaps I would advise the committee to consider taking the date away if it's going to bring an end date into the bill. I think the taking into account the issue around the economy and all of that, as the department, is something that we always advise credit providers. I mean, there are many mechanisms that we are putting in place to ensure that we curb reckless lending, over indebtedness. But in all these efforts that we're making, we still find people continuing issuing loans recklessly. So as a balancing act, people who are running businesses or that are in the lending space should ensure that whenever they give consumers credit, they ensure that they actually apply the affordability assessment regulations to ensure that people get access to credit because they qualify. Hence, I would actually advise the committee, if the date is going to, you know, make it a once-off, we rather take away the date and make it continuously and remove the minister's powers as we have proposed, and people can approach the NCR and NCT in relation to debt intervention as and when they are required to do so or when they feel that there's a need to do so. Because on the other side, one problem that we want to address is the issue of vulnerable and defrauded people, the target group, which is continuously on a daily basis get to be victimized because they can't resist it. They get to be given credit, you know, recklessly on a continuous basis. For credit providers to refrain from doing that, you also have to have a cap in terms of saying, if my business model allows for a system where I would give loans to the vulnerable, I should actually be taking the consequences that arise from that, in the sense that those people will actually approach the DTI and NCR and NCT for a debt intervention because I actually gave them loans recklessly. So in looking at the bigger picture of balancing the systematic nature of the credit market versus what should actually be given as credit to people who qualify, credit providers should take accountability and responsibility. Hence we are saying, if there's a disaster, retrenchment, or people are over indebted because we have actually given them loans when they are in actual fact, they do not, then they must apply for a debt intervention process. So in essence, Chair, I'm proposing that if the date is going to prevent people from continuously going to NCR for help and NCT, then we rather get rid of the date. And so that's my point.
Thank you. Now, before anybody, I just want an advocate to come in to just answer those questions we had. Thank you.
Thank you. you. Chair, definitely we can, because what we can do, if we are concerned about making it an open process, maybe more so, I'll speak to the consultation part, but more so because we are concerned about possible impact that we might not have considered, then my proposal would be, first off, I think that the bill needs to have, the bill cannot come into operation on the date that it is assented to. The bill needs to be put into operation on a date promulgated by the President, because the department is not going to be ready to implement, and if the bill is in operation, people can start applying. So we cannot have that done. So once the department is ready, there's then a measure or a letter or something that the minister will send to the President. The President will then publish a promulgation to say, this act is operational from this date. So let's say the act is operational from 1 December 2019. We can put in a clause that says this measure, and then I think we need to think about the process from the NCR, because I don't think there's any constitutional concerns about the NCR assisting people with a process similar to debt review and the actual extinguishing of the debt. So if we put a time limit, I would recommend that it only be in respect of the extinguishing, the suspension and the extinguishing, and then we can say this section will only be operational, it's called a sunset clause. It will only be operational from the date on that this act is operational, it becomes effective for a period of, and I would suggest perhaps 24 months. We did not put a cut-off date, we did not put an end date for when applications could be submitted. We only put the end date of the credit, of the debt that you've incurred. So there was no, this could have, and in fact some of the comments received said you'll be working on this for 10 years. So if we make it a 24 period or a 36 months period, what we can include in the bill also is that the minister can review that sunset clause and table a report in Parliament to consider whether the sunset clause should be amended. So we can make provision for that, but it must be reviewed. So that is the one possibility. The issue of consultation, I think that there was sufficient comments about the date, about retrospectivity, about the minister's powers to make this a permanent measure, that we do not have to consult again if we open it up. We must keep in mind, first of all, in fact, we are having this discussion on a number of bills actually now. Parliament cannot be expected to keep on going back to the public to say, look, I've now listened to what you said. I hear you don't want the minister to make this a permanent solution. Then I'll change my solution to be that. And now I must go back to you again because I listened to what you said and I've made these amendments. I mean, it is always open to the committee to say, look, we feel a bit uncomfortable. We would like to publish. We have done that before with IP Laws Amendment. You simply put the specific clause up for comment, and you do not even have to have public hearings unless your comments are such that you feel you need to have public hearings. So it is something that can be done. It does not mean that it should not be in the bill. But like I say, I'm of the view if it comes from the problems that are identified by the comments, and this is the solution that we're arriving at, then we need not go back to the public. We need to keep in mind also that this bill will not be sent to the President once it's passed by the Assembly. It is tagged as the 76th bill, so it will go to the NCOP, where it will be also extensively consulted in every single province, and there will be inputs coming back. Chances are there will be amendments, and the bill will be coming back to this committee. If the committee agrees, of course, then it's accepted, or there's a mediation process. So I think that there's a lot of consultation that has happened on this bill and that will still happen in terms of must. But it is open to the committee to say, look, we feel uncomfortable, we want to publish, but in my view, it is something that results from the comments received from the public, the concerns raised by the public, that it is rather that the power that we're giving to the minister to make a permanent measure is plenary. And it shouldn't be for the minister, that should be something for Parliament. So, yeah.
Okay, so just to get some clarity for me and for other members, so basically what we're saying about these two points is that we'll remove the date, the 27th of November. Then, when the department is ready, they'll send a letter to the President and he'll promulgate a date when the bill becomes effective. And then, within that date, within that period, within our legislation, do we put in the 24-month where debt extinguishing can take place? And at the same time that that's happening, the debt review process through the National Credit Regulator will be ongoing forever, so that we can cover the gap, the people that don't qualify for debt review currently. Is that what we're saying?
Yes.
Do we all agree, members? Okay. Silence is consent. Thank you. Honourable Albert has agreed to take us all to lunch later because of his... Okay. So that's what we're going to go. Can we move to the next... Did the department want to come in for anything else? Because really what you must try to understand is we're moving through clause by clause fundamentally. So we're just trying to get a picture in our mind of exactly what the... we're trying to get the implications and everything. So that's what we're looking for. And you're here to advise us if there's any trickiness. Yeah, fundamentally. Thank you. Thank you, Advocate.
Okay. The next... Okay, so we've covered the once-off. We've covered retrospectively because all of that will then apply. So... The role of creditors, the next one. Should the role of creditors provided be implied or explicit? I think that is not actually a question that we need to worry about, because if we are using existing measures, then we are in any event providing for them to be clearly part of the process. What we perhaps can discuss is in the NCT, there was the opinion from the National Treasury said there must be at least a written submission from the credit provider. So that is perhaps something that we can simply say, that when there is a suspension or an extension of a suspension, the credit provider can make a written submission, and then of course there will be the normal appeal processes available.
Members, please, any inputs on that? I agree with Honourable Advocate on this one. Is there anybody who doesn't agree with this? Honourable Albert?
I think I do agree with this one. I don't think I have anything else to add. Thank you.
Okay, we can move to the next one.
Okay. This one is where the NCT should perhaps just speak to the committee. There were concerns about a single NCT member being able to consider suspension or extinguishing of a debt. The thing is, currently a single magistrate can do it. Now the argument is that not all tribunal members are legally trained. I'm saying the counter argument is that the tribunal has the responsibility to adjudicate these matters, and that they must see to it that their members are duly trained. So if a member is more like an economist or something like that, that is not the member that should be allocated to be considering matters as a single tribunal member. But I think the NCT can perhaps speak better to that. But I'm of the view that, you know, I think it's actually, in fact, I want to go as far as saying it's insulting to say that a single tribunal member cannot hear a matter, but a single magistrate can hear a matter that deals with anything. Economy, finance, science, etc., etc. So I do think that the Act provides properly for tribunal members and their qualifications, and I'm sure that the NCT will make sure that the person that does a single, that sits as a single tribunal member, will have the necessary skill or support to do that.
Before the NCT comes in, I just want to know, was this question raised by members, or was this question raised by the public in a public hearing?
By the public.
Okay, and NCT?
Thanks, Chair. It was also raised by one of the members. I remember Honourable McPherson was very much concerned about whether a senior tribunal member can be trusted with the task. The fact of the matter, Chair, is that the tribunal members are already adjudicating certain matters as single members. It's not every matter that they sit as three in a panel. But then those decisions of the single member are appealable to a full panel of three members if the parties, either party appeals for whatever reason. So there's a provision for that which enables that they'd only have to pay expensive fees going to the High Court to process an appeal or a review. Unlike in the magistrate courts, where if you have to go on appeal, you have to incur costs, now legal costs, to process that. So it is already happening, and it is because of the appeal safety net that we are happy that this can be done. Also, the fact that some members are not qualified legally does not really quite wash, because these people operate within a statute. They do not apply common law and their common sense. They are forced by the statute to operate within the four walls of that statute. So it's all prescribed. This is why we have said to the committee, our recommendation is that if you feel that there might be some biases that you're not compatible with, then just build in some criteria that members should consider when applying their minds. That criteria normally then safeguards that. At one point, I remember saying to the committee, you could even put in what you would call codes of good practice, which can be attached and made part of the Act by a section. And then it must be taken into account. That one then maps out what a member must consider and the proportionality of the consideration and whether it should be by line or it should be a combination of these criteria, etc., etc. The judges always prescribe that when there is none. And then we end up following their judgments and importing that criteria where there is no criteria in the statute. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would just like to make a note, unfortunately, because we have no time to caucus tomorrow, our party, we have a caucus now at 11:30, so I need to leave after this answering this question, unfortunately. this question, this clause and, well, this question clause 14 and the next one sort of dovetails with each other, I think. I think it seems fine if there's a single member with the right to appeal to three members is in place. We're not allowed to, due to the legal advice that we've been given, we're not allowed to intervene in the discretion of the member itself to prescribe what they must do. But I think, I'm not sure if guidelines would be possible. For some of the advice that I've been given is that we should try to create a phased-in approach, or I'm looking for the right word, but basically what it comes down to is that there should be guidelines where a person, depending on how indebted they are or not, how much they could write off. So they are not bound to write off everything. They can say, okay, I will write off 50% of your debt, considering what your financial status is now. Or I will write off 80% and extend the term to pay off the 20% that's left. So the extinguishing does take place, but it doesn't necessarily have to be 100% all the time. And those are guidelines. It doesn't have obviously, they're not bound to follow it, but it will give them an idea. Maybe a practice will develop over time that would be sensible and fair both towards the applicant and the creditors. Thank you.
Other members, have you got anything to say? No? Yeah, I just want to say that on this matter, by time it gets to the NCT, and the person is sitting, you know, with this pile of should we extinguish or not in front of them, surely the process that's been done, it's a recommendation from the National Credit Regulator that they do in fact get their debt extinguished. It's not like they've just walked off the street and then they've asked for extinguishing. There is a whole process before they go there. So the National Credit Regulator obviously is going to take that process seriously, very seriously, and not just recommend everybody gets their debt extinguished. They're going to have to account, you know, why they, you know, eventually extinguished all that debt. So I think that one person is fine, and I also think that the appeal process with three people is fine. So I do think that we should just leave it as the one, because it's not like they've just walked off the street. There has been this whole process, which is going to take quite some time before they get to that point of actually extinguishing. Do members agree or disagree? What's dealing with? Please, members.
Yeah, I think
Chair, I'm reluctant to comment because I was out when this discussion started. I don't want to take
okay.
you away.
Okay, so I think we should just go with the one.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Just a moment. We're just going before you move to the next one, advocate. I just want to engage with the secretary for a second.
Because you can, the thing is, then it makes it.